Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi there, Herman and Corin. So not to belabor the topic or the experience too much, but one of the things we've talked about digital preparedness, and the only reason that I'm thinking again about my experience living through the 12-day war between Israel and Iran this summer gone by is that it's back front and center in the news again, with the Iranian regime of the IRGC seeming very shaky and the US apparently thinking about it's moving so quickly, who knows, by the time you check Google News, the whole picture has changed. So it's back in the news and everyone in Israel is a bit nervous because the question is, could the conflict spill over to here? And I've remarked before that on the times that it did, it was never kind of very easy to call until just before it broke out. And one of the learnings that I had from the conflict was, one of the first learnings about my own preparedness was that when you go down to a shelter underground, the better the shelter that you find, which certain car parks are used here because they've got a lot of concrete in them, they're certified for this purpose, that makes it almost impossible for cellular networks to penetrate down into them. The other learning, one of the first learnings, was you can't rely upon anyone else in these kind of situations. So the authorities had, in their wisdom, put Ethernet ports in the safe rooms, which were 6 or 7 stories underground, so that when you're there, you had a way to reach the outside world and know what was going on. And more importantly, get the instructions from the authorities to know when it was safe and what was going on. It becomes extremely unnerving when you know that there's ballistic missiles heading towards potentially your city, but you've no idea. You can't hear. You're so far deep that you mightn't be able to hear. You might be able to hear vague interception sounds, but that's all the information you have. So that's kind of a freaky feeling. But they hadn't, no one had thought that just putting an Ethernet jack isn't going to really help the 99% of people who don't happen to show up with a laptop and an Ethernet port. Well, guess what, Herman and Corin? I was that 1%. You won't be surprised to know. I had my travel router, and I was, after the first day when I got there, and we were back and forth for a week in this thing, and I realized, wait, I have a travel router. That would totally work. It's battery powered. There was no power, but it's got an Ethernet jack, and that got a network up and running. And it was a game changer because not just me, but everyone else sheltering could now get the official all clear instructions. And just watching the news was helpful. Even when the news was kind of scary, I think we all found it better to know than not to know. But this got me thinking, this experience of, let's say you were in a slightly different situation and you didn't even have this Ethernet port to rely upon, but you found some kind of deep shelter, and cellular is going to be at the ground level and you're going to lose it as you go down. But let's say you're a few stories underground. Now, what I was thinking was, wait, couldn't a mesh network setup do this? If you had your first node kind of by the door and you just put one on each floor, battery powered, and you brought your network down and down, could it work? And I'm not really asking about, as you know, kind of obviously watching streaming high quality, high definition movies down there. I'm talking about getting a basic viable internet connection in an emergency. So that's my question, Herman and Corin. We've talked about the flip side, the disadvantages of mesh networks, that the latency can really add up across hops. And, you know, it mightn't be a good connection for that reason, or it mightn't work. Maybe no one makes this. It is a pretty niche use case, right? But maybe someone has. So Herman and Corin, let's talk about this. Does it exist, technology to bring internet underground in a sort of preppy manner if one wanted to equip themselves with such gear? And what would you be even looking for? Herman and Corin, over to you. Let's talk about this.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to My Weird Prompts. I am Korn, and I am sitting here in our living room in Jerusalem, looking out at a surprisingly clear sky today.
And I am Herman Poppleberry. It is a beautiful day, Korn, but as our housemate Daniel reminded us in that voice note, the peace and quiet can feel a bit fragile sometimes. He has been thinking a lot about digital preparedness lately, specifically what happens when you have to head underground.
Yeah, Daniel really tapped into a universal anxiety for anyone living in a modern city with deep shelters. You go down 5 or 6 flights of stairs, the concrete walls are 3 feet thick, and suddenly your phone is just a very expensive paperweight. No bars, no data, no connection to the world above.
It is a literal Faraday cage. Those shelters are designed to keep things out, but unfortunately, that includes the radio waves we rely on for everything from news updates to checking in with family. Daniel was asking if a battery-powered mesh network could be the answer, essentially leapfrogging the internet from the surface down into the depths.
It is a fascinating engineering challenge. We have touched on networking basics before, like in episode 184 when we did that deep dive into the OSI model, but this is a very practical, high-stakes application. Can you actually build a reliable data bridge using off-the-shelf gear in the middle of an emergency?
The short answer is yes. But the long answer involves a lot of physics, some very specific hardware choices, and an understanding of how signal attenuation works in heavy construction. I have actually been looking into this since Daniel mentioned it, and the technology has evolved quite a bit in the last couple of years.
Well, before we get into the gear, let's talk about the problem. Why exactly does the signal die so fast? I mean, I can get Wi-Fi through a couple of walls in my house, but the moment I step into that stairwell leading to the shelter, it is gone.
It comes down to frequency and material density. Most cellular signals and standard Wi-Fi operate at high frequencies, like 2.4 GHz or 5 GHz. These waves are great for carrying a lot of data, but they are terrible at penetrating dense materials. Reinforced concrete is the ultimate enemy here because it is not just rock, it is rock filled with a grid of steel rebar.
Right. The rebar acts like a mesh itself, scattering and absorbing the signal.
Exactly. It is like trying to shine a flashlight through a thick wool blanket. By the time the wave gets through one floor of a parking garage or a shelter, it has lost 90% of its strength. By the third floor, it is effectively noise. This is why Daniel's idea of a mesh network is so intuitive. Instead of trying to blast a signal through the ceiling, you are essentially creating a bucket brigade of data along the path of least resistance.
So, instead of one big antenna on the roof, you are placing small nodes at every turn of the stairs or on every landing.
Precisely. You are keeping the distance between nodes short enough that they can talk to each other through the air in the stairwell or through just one wall at a time. Each node receives the data, refreshes the signal, and passes it to the next one.
Okay, so let's look at the input side of this. If the goal is to bring the internet underground, you need an internet source at the entrance that actually works when the local cell towers might be overloaded or down.
This is where things have changed recently. For a long time, you were stuck relying on a local cell signal at the door, which is risky in a real emergency. But back in mid-2024, SpaceX released the Starlink Mini. I know we mentioned it briefly in a past episode, but for this specific scenario, it is a game changer. It is about the size of a laptop, it can run off a standard USB-C power bank, and it gives you a direct link to a satellite constellation.
So you set the Starlink Mini up just outside the entrance, or maybe in a window with a clear view of the sky, and that becomes your gateway node.
Right. That provides the initial high-speed backhaul. But then you have the challenge of getting that signal down the stairs. You wouldn't want to use another Starlink dish for that, obviously. You need something small, portable, and battery efficient.
I'm assuming we are looking at those travel routers you are always obsessing over.
You know me too well. Specifically, the gear from GLINET has become the gold standard for this kind of DIY mesh setup. They have models like the Beryl AX or the Slate AX. These are small, pocket-sized routers that run on OpenWRT, which is an open-source operating system for routers.
What makes them better than, say, just a bunch of old home routers I have in the closet?
Power and flexibility. Those GLINET routers can be powered by the same USB power banks you use for your phone. In an emergency, you don't have wall outlets. You need something that can run for 12 or 24 hours on a battery. Plus, they support WDS, which stands for Wireless Distribution System.
That is the protocol that allows them to mesh together wirelessly without needing Ethernet cables between them.
So, if Daniel wanted to set this up, he would have a Starlink Mini at the surface, connected via a short Ethernet cable to his first GLI net router. Then he drops a second router one flight down, a third router another flight down, and so on.
Exactly. And because these are Wi-Fi 6 devices, they have much better range and congestion management than the older tech. Even though we are seeing Wi-Fi 7 gear hit the market now in early 2026 for an emergency mesh, Wi-Fi 6 is the sweet spot because the hardware is affordable and the battery draw is very predictable.
I'm curious about the latency, though. Daniel mentioned this in his note. Every time you hop from one node to another, doesn't that slow things down?
It does. Every wireless hop typically cuts your potential bandwidth in half and adds a few milliseconds of delay. If you have 5 hops to get to the bottom of a deep shelter, you aren't going to be gaming or editing high-definition video. But for what Daniel is talking about, checking the news, receiving official instructions, or sending a text to a loved one, it is more than enough. You might go from 300 megabits at the surface to maybe 10 or 15 megabits at the bottom, but 10 megabits in a bunker feels like a miracle when everyone else has zero.
That is a great point. It is the difference between total isolation and a functional connection. But how do you actually manage the placement of these nodes? If I'm in a rush, I'm not exactly going to be doing a site survey with professional tools.
That is the beauty of the mesh. Most of these modern travel routers have a simple LED indicator or a phone app that shows the signal strength between nodes. You just walk down the stairs until the light turns from green to yellow, then you back up a few steps and place the node there. You can use heavy-duty mounting tape or even just set them on a ledge.
It sounds like something that requires a bit of a kit, prepared in advance. You can't just wing this with one router.
Definitely not. If you are serious about this, you need a dedicated go bag for your network. I actually put one together after we talked about logistics and resilience back in episode 230. My kit has 3 GLI NetSlate AX routers, 3 20,000 mAh batteries, and a bunch of flat Ethernet cables just in case the wireless mesh gets too much interference.
Flat cables are smart. You can run them under doors or through tight gaps without pinching the wires.
Precisely. And if you have those cables, you can eliminate that half bandwidth penalty I mentioned earlier. If you can run a cable between two nodes, the mesh becomes incredibly stable.
Let's talk about the software side for a second. If you are setting up a public mesh in a shelter full of people, security has to be an issue. You don't want someone on floor 3 snooping on what someone on floor 5 is doing.
That is one of the big risks. In an emergency, people get desperate for information, and a rogue node could easily be set up to perform a man-in-the-middle attack. This is where the OpenWRT firmware is so valuable. You can set up an encrypted bridge using WireGuard. We talked about encryption in the BGP hijacking episode, number 231, and the same principles apply here. You want to make sure the tunnel from the bottom of the shelter to the Starlink at the top is encrypted, so that even if someone intercepts the wireless signal in the stairwell, they can't read the data.
That makes sense. But there is also a social aspect to this. If you bring the internet to a shelter where 200 people are hiding, and they all see a Wi-Fi network called Emergency Internet, they are all going to jump on it. Your 10 megabit connection is going to collapse instantly.
That is a very real problem. If 200 phones start trying to sync their cloud photos and update their apps the moment they hit the Wi-Fi, the network will die. If you are the one running the mesh, you have to be the administrator. You would need to set up what is called Quality of Service, or QoS, rules. You basically tell the router to prioritize tiny packets of data, like text messages and news headlines, and block or heavily throttle big things like video streaming or app updates.
I can imagine that being a bit of a tense situation. Sorry everyone, no TikTok in the bunker. We need the bandwidth for the Homefront command updates.
It sounds funny, but in a high-stress environment, having a digital gatekeeper is actually a service to the community. You are preserving a scarce resource. You could even set a captive portal, you know, like those splash pages you see at hotels that says, "This is an emergency network. Please use text only."
That is a really practical takeaway. Now, Daniel also asked if this technology exists specifically for emergency preparedness. Are there companies selling bunker Wi-Fi kits?
There are. But they are mostly targeted at the industrial and mining sectors. Companies like Rajant or Silvus Technologies make kinetic mesh systems that are incredibly rugged. They are used in underground mines and by military units. They can handle massive interference and have self-healing capabilities, meaning if one node gets crushed or loses power, the others automatically find a new path.
I'm guessing those aren't exactly budget-friendly for the average person living in an apartment.
Not at all. A single node from those companies can cost thousands of dollars. For someone like us, or for Daniel, the prosumer route is much more realistic. Combining a Starlink for the source with a handful of high-end travel routers gives you about 80% of the performance of those military systems at 5% of the cost.
It is interesting how the consumer market has caught up. I remember when mesh was this exotic thing that only enterprise offices had. Now you can buy a 3-pack of nodes at a big box store for $200.
True. But those home mesh systems like Aero or Nest are often too dumb for this. They really want to be plugged into a wall and managed by a cloud server. If they lose their connection to the internet, sometimes you can't even log into the local settings to fix them. That is why I keep pushing the open WRT gear. It works entirely offline. You are the master of the hardware.
Okay, so we have talked about Wi-Fi-based mesh, but what about other types of emergency networks? I've seen things like GoTenna or these LoRa-based systems. How do they fit into the underground shelter scenario?
That is a great alternative if you don't need the internet specifically, but just need to communicate. LoRa stands for long range. It is a low power, low bandwidth radio technology. There is a huge open source project called Meshtastic that uses LoRa.
I've heard of that. People use it for hiking and off-grid communication, right?
Exactly. Each device is about the size of a deck of cards and has a little antenna. They don't send photos or video. It is purely for text messages and GPS coordinates. But here is the kicker. LoRa is much better at penetrating obstacles than Wi-Fi. It operates at much lower frequencies, usually around 915 MHz in the United States or 868 MHz in Europe and Israel. And Israel...
So it might actually make it through a floor or two of concrete without needing a node in the middle.
Exactly. In my testing, a Meshtastic node can often punch through two or three floors of a parking garage where Wi-Fi would give up after one. If your goal is just to stay in touch with the people in the shelter or send a "We are safe" message to someone at the surface, a LoRa mesh is actually more reliable and the batteries last for days, not hours.
So maybe the ultimate setup is a hybrid? You have the Wi-Fi mesh for when you need to check the news and the LoRa mesh as the failsafe for basic coordination.
That is, the belt and braces approach. If I were designing a dream setup for our building, that is exactly what I would do. I would have a Meshtastic node permanently mounted in the shelter and one in our apartment. Even if the power goes out and the Wi-Fi mesh fails, those little LoRa nodes will keep chirping away on their internal batteries.
It is funny how we have moved from the internet is a luxury to the internet is a critical utility, especially in these moments of crisis. It reminds me of our conversation in episode 229 about the rental market and how the law often fails to keep up with basic needs. Having a connection isn't just about entertainment. It is about safety and mental health.
Absolutely. The psychological impact of being in the dark is huge. When you can see a map, read an official update, or just see a thumbs up emoji from a friend, your heart rate drops. It turns an emergency into a manageable situation.
So, if we were to give Daniel a shopping list for his bunker mesh kit, what are the essentials?
Okay, number one, a Starlink Mini. It is the only reliable way to get high-speed data if the local ground infrastructure is compromised. Number two, at least 3 GLI Net Slate AX routers. They are small, powerful, and run on USB. Number three, three large power banks, at least 20,000 milliamp hours each, with USB-C power delivery.
And don't forget the cables.
Right, a handful of 10-foot flat Ethernet cables. And finally, I would add two Meshtastic nodes, like the Heltec VisionMaster or the LilyGo T-Beam. They are cheap, maybe $30 or $40 each, and they provide that low-bandwidth lifeline that won't quit.
It sounds like a lot of gear, but when you think about it, it all fits into a single backpack.
It does. And you don't just use it for emergencies. I take those travel routers every time we go on a trip. They are great for staying secure on hotel Wi-Fi.
True. I remember you setting that up when we went to that tech conference last year. It was nice having our own little private bubble of internet in the middle of a crowded lobby.
See? Practical and prepared. That is the Poppleberry way.
Speaking of being prepared, one thing we haven't touched on is the legal side of this. If you were setting up a Starlink in a mesh network in a public space, do you run into any issues with local regulations?
In a declared emergency, those rules usually go out the window. Authorities are generally happy if citizens are finding ways to stay informed and calm. However, you should always be aware of where you are placing your gear. You don't want to block emergency exits or interfere with the actual first responders' radio frequencies. Most of the gear we are talking about operates in unlicensed bands, so it is perfectly legal to use, but you have to be respectful of the physical space.
That is a good point. You don't want your emergency kit to become a tripping hazard for people rushing into the shelter.
Exactly. Use that mounting tape I mentioned. Keep the cables tucked against the corners of the stairs. Be a good digital citizen.
I think what I love most about this topic is how it empowers the individual. We often feel so helpless when big systems fail, whether it is the power grid or the cell network. But with a little bit of knowledge and a few $100 worth of gear, you can actually build your own infrastructure.
It is the ultimate My Weird Prompts topic. It combines technical nerdery with real-world survival. And honestly, it is a great project for a weekend. You don't have to wait for an emergency to test this. Go to a local multi-story parking garage on a quiet Sunday and see if you can get a signal from the roof to the basement. It is a fun way to learn about networking.
I can see the headline now. Two brothers found skulking in parking garage with laptops and batteries. Claim it is for a podcast.
Hey, if it works, it works. And I guarantee you, the moment someone else in that garage sees they have 5 bars of Wi-Fi in the basement, they're going to think we are geniuses.
Or wizards. Possibly both. You know, it is interesting to think about how this might evolve in the next few years. We are already seeing direct-to-cell satellite technology being tested. Companies like T-Mobile and SpaceX are working on ways for your standard phone to talk directly to a satellite for emergency texts.
That is the holy grail. But the physics are still tough. Those signals are very weak because they are coming from hundreds of miles away. They will work great if you are standing in an open field, but they still won't penetrate 6 floors of concrete. So even in the future, the mesh approach, getting the signal to the door and then relaying it inside, is still going to be the most reliable method for deep shelters.
So Daniel's idea isn't just a workaround for today. It is likely going to be the standard operating procedure for a long time.
I think so. The last mile of connectivity is often the hardest, but in this case, the last 50 yards is the real challenge.
Well, I think we have given Daniel a lot to chew on. It is a brilliant question, and it really highlights how much the landscape of preparedness has shifted from just having extra water and batteries to having a plan for your data.
It is the 21st century survival kit. Water, food, first aid, and a mesh network.
I might have to add a few of those GLI net routers to my own kit now. You've convinced me, Herman.
My work here is done. But seriously, if anyone listening has actually deployed a mesh like this in a real-world situation, we would love to hear about it. What worked? What failed? Did the concrete win? Or did the data get through?
Yeah, reach out to us. You can find the contact form on our website at myweirdprompts.com. We love getting these kinds of boots-on-the-ground reports.
And if you've been listening to us for a while and you find these deep dives helpful, please take a second to leave us a review on your podcast app or on Spotify. It really does help other curious minds find the show.
It really does. We have been doing this for over 200 episodes now, and the community of listeners we have built is just incredible. Thanks for being part of it.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
And I'm Korn. Thanks to Daniel for the prompt, and thanks to all of you for listening. We will catch you in the next one.
Stay connected, stay safe, and keep asking those weird questions.
Take care, everyone.
Bye for now.
So, Herman, are we actually going to go to that parking garage this Sunday?
I already have the batteries charging. Korn, you bring the snacks, I'll bring the Slate AX.
Deal. But if the security guard asks what we are doing, you're the one explaining the OSI model to him.
I'll start with layer 1, the physical layer. He'll be asleep in 5 minutes.
Perfect. All right, let's get out of here.
See you on the website, everyone. MyWeirdPrompts.com. Check out the RSS feed while you're there.
Peace.
And out.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.